representa. Altså, ja, så står det at den som er sånn creator of knowledge,
ja.
Og for så vidt en actor selv, altså lever i samfunnet selv.
Ja.
Men, men sånn generelt så er det den enkelte at det en gruppe til oss som den som forsker driver også opp.
Direkker.
De ser på, for eksempel vurderer hvordan er vår oppfattning da.
Ja.
Realiteten og...
Hva har du forstått det riktig?
Ja, det bra, jeg har noe tid. Men jeg har litt problem å komme ordentlig inngrep med... Jeg har forlekt seg til dette der med language... som jeg snakket om der, og på en måte få det egentlig... Ja, fullt ut og skjønne det.
Ja, ja, men det altså...
Og få det lik i det, og altså... Jeg tror vi må ha...
Jo, for det et relativt komplisert tema.
Ja.
Så det liksom, jeg tror du bare kan forklare det med, liksom, på et grunnleggende, med et grunnleggende perspektiv.
Ja.
Så det liksom sånn vi har ikke nok inn på en, og så det på en måte komfortabelt på i dybden på det, føler jeg.
Nei.
Det får du, det funker.
Gjør det da?
Ja.
Så bra.
Skal jeg sjekke om lyden funker, hvis du har skrudd på mikrofonen?
Ja, skrudd på mikrofonen. Får jeg høre da? Yes. Ja. Nei, jeg prøver dobbelt, for jeg ikke trygg på det. Har vært, det systemet har vært i uorden. Så da kjører jeg både svivel og det faste systemet her i dag, så får jeg se hva som funker. Jeg tør ikke å kjøre noe som ikke i orden. Rett og slett. Og da tenker jeg det at da kan jeg heller prøve også å gjøre. Kan jeg teste det ut? Jeg har ikke tid til å kjøre det, og lage en ting. Og i dag så skal vi gjennom noe som er vanskeligere. Nå begynner vi på de vanskelige tingene. Yes, but...
Det er undervisning her nedsluttet, sånn som det er satt opp.
Yes.
Ja, så er det andre enn det så...
Ja. We can look at this lecture plan. I'm just taking it one more time. There. The lecture plan. Week 40 is still going as planned. I'm not... There isn't anything. Yeah, it's the holidays. That's why. But we don't have that type of holiday at the university. That's what the rector said. We don't have autumn holiday at universities. So I felt a little bit foolish and I suggested that. We don't have that. So, anyhow. But the main point is that the 41st, we will have a guest lecture, I hope. And it is Elias Karyanis, who is coming here. He is a professor at George Washington University at Washington, D.C., and but he is not coming on a Tuesday. He is arriving in Norway on Wednesday and will be here until Friday. So my suggestion was that we will, if we can, we can have a lecture on Thursday. Is that all right?
Yeah.
Yep.
At what time,
please? I'm not quite sure yet. I need to order some, room or whatever.
Okay, but if I can just wish, I would like it to be before 3:30.
Before 3:30.
Yeah, because actually I start to work at 3:30.
Yeah, yes. But most likely it will be before that. And as you can see, you remember that I had I had put, let me just move this upwards. We have these three pillars. No. Okay. So you can see that most of the society pillar, he is going through. He is lecturing the triple, quadruple, and quintuple helix model, and he is also then touching upon macro and meso perspective. So that's why I think that this lecture is important. And then we have manual lab the week after. Hello. And manual lab is not present here, and then we need to have the whole day also. I hope that we are still planning this. It's Olga and John, if you have met them, two PhD students. They are going to use the exercise in their hopefully in their PhD also research. So it is kind of making the opportunity. And what I hope they can do is to say, let you try to set up a production line. First of all, as perhaps a scientific management way, how will the production line then look? And then you can decide yourself, or it is lean or whatever, and then another way, a third way, perhaps a Swedish way, the horseshoe mounting. And then you can, I hope that by that time you will see very much what is the difference. And nobody has done that, actually. I have never read anyone who has done that. But they are, all researchers has very clear meanings about one or the other, but they have never tried the one or the other. They always tried just the one, or going from one to another. That's some have done, but never tried one, and then the other, and then the third one. Never. So that would be the first. So I hope that this can be a good way of looking into the deeper insights in this line of work. Okay. So is this clear then? So we're having a presentation or a lecture next week, and then we have a guest lecture, and then we have manual lab, and then we follow this. I'm not quite sure yet. We are discussing.
Yeah.
Because they wanted just to give us a corner of a room, but I said that is not good enough. We need access to both sides of the table, etc., and lots of room so that we can rearrange and change. So, yeah. Is that clear? Okay. Quite funny to try to steer the mouse in a different screen. Okay, what we are now going to talk about is supply chain or value chain. Value chain is what economics and business strategists call it. Supply chain is more what engineers call it. But many times it's one and the same. So please excuse me if I have one or the other, because my master is in economics and my PhD is in more in engineering. So please excuse me, I'm confused. Okay, let us start. If the whole point of a supply chain design is to try to make things better. Here you have the supply chain performance and the total cost. And perhaps it is a curve like this. And all lean efforts you did was to try to flatten this curve, wasn't it? So it the cost did not go through the roof. That was the main point. Because if you don't have the tools and understanding and so on, if you then demand more output through the production line, then the cost tends to go through the roof. You just employ more people, buy more equipment, etc., etc. So that's the main point there. And what we are going to look at is how can we do this with different companies? Because a supply chain is not a single company. It's not one entity. It is many entities. And how do we do that with many entities? Right? And then you get a shift in the curve and perhaps a reduced cost. And we will look into why we can have reduced cost and still perform better. And also, or looking at that, one of the main points is to truly understand storage or storages and inventory. If you understand inventory, you can understand a lot. And I had, perhaps if we have time, I will also point towards a very celebrated economic theory. You two have had it, transaction cost economics. And if you remember, I was talking last semester about hostage taking. Do you remember that?
Mm-hmm.
And then this is in the middle of hostage taking. So I will go through that. And transaction cost economics has, I think they have won 4 or 6 Nobel Prizes in economics. So it is one of the major theories into economics thinking in supply chain design. Right? And it's not covered by the materials that I have put up at all. I'm going to put up some more, but I didn't manage to translate it to English. Back to English. Yes?
I don't have any experience in this, so would you recommend me to maybe
look up some literature on the subject? I can try to find something. Do not look up what the Nobel Prize winners has written, because then you are lost. It is really, really difficult to understand. But I can try to find something. I think I have something. Yeah, I will do that. But let's go through what we have. What I've said already is covered by these points here. The goal is to reduce cost and at the same time increase performance. That's obvious, isn't it? Value chain, supply chain must be managed, yeah? And you can see the rest. I'm not going through that. I think you can read it, and these are something that, yeah, says everything or nothing. If you're going to put up such a claim, then you need, in your writing, to prove it. You need to say that this is... I forgot this one. you need to make evidence of this, and you need also to point out key words, and then try to argue for those key words. Right? This you should have learned in the bachelor degree. But let's take this just for an example. So if I say that supply chain is important for service and internet businesses as well as manufacturing, then I would start by saying that supply chain is derived from manufacturing, which is true, and then I can go through Ford, GM, and everything in, and say that they have suppliers, that they don't produce all the car themselves, but they have suppliers. That's enough. But then I need to make you understand why it's important for services. And that's more difficult, isn't it? So, let's take banking as an example. Then I would say that banking today is not done me going to one office with my money to put it into my account. This is done electronically, and the electronically devices and programs are produced by not the bank itself, it is produced by suppliers. They produce it, they program it, etc., etc. Okay? And then you have internet businesses. You can imagine this yourself, I think. But this is the way you argue. We are going to come back to that later on when you have written your first essay. And by the way, please talk to each other and make a date. And let me know of the deadline. Then we put that deadline on. Because I think it is up to you. You are going to do the work, so then you can decide yourself when the deadline is. And if you're not agreeing, then I will decide you myself. All right, did you understand this? That this is the way we do and argue. All right. So, these are... No. These are some of the claims of supply chain. So, and... It started in manufacturing as inventory control, and also by tiers. I'm going to talk about tiers later, so please just, it is suppliers, but we tend to categorize suppliers, how near or far they are from us, right? We are going to look at it later. Just this one slide or two. Okay. Here you have a flower shop. A florist. You can see the main contributors to having a flower on demand florist. You have the two customers, home customer and commercial customers. This is firms, right? These are the two main customer groups. And then you have some internet to often, which you order. Have you done this? Have you? Yeah, one? Order a flower to anyone on the website. No, you do that yourself. You pick every flower and...
Of course.
Yeah. I have to admit that I don't pick any flower. I just go into the internet and... Yeah, that's so high. This price is good, so then order. I do that sometimes. Not a lot, but anyhow. Then you have maintenance service, whatever that may be. You have FedEx, for instance, the delivery service. And then you have perhaps a local delivery, and you have an internet service. All of these reds are very important in order to make this happen. And then you have packaging, you have flowers that comes from both national and international, and then you have arrangement materials. All the rest are, that is not flowers. So this is a supply chain for a florist. So now perhaps you get an idea, but the next one is more traditional. These are the traditional way of thinking of a supply chain. So let us go through it. You have retail, you have shops. Perhaps this is a car, is it? No, but let's say it's a car manufacturer. So you have different areas where you have a shop or shops. And then you have distribution centers, also called wholesalers, right? Norwegian grossist. And then you have now the assembly line, or often also called OEM. QEM is a different thing. Sorry. OEM, original equipment manufacturer. Merkevare eier in Norwegian. Right? So this could be Ford, Honda, Mazda, etc. Right? And then you have the main sub-assembly. For instance, if you the steering wheel, they have many buttons and so on, and has an airbag into it. It comes pre-assembled to the main assembly line, right? They don't do that because then they needed a new factory. So it's more easy to put it outside to the tier one. These are the tier one. And for instance, the wheels, they come pre-assembly with the hub and the tires and the wheels, right? And then if you go with the tires, then you have tier two could be the ones who makes the tires. Dunlop, Pirelli, etc. And tier three is the ones who makes the rubber. So you see you have layers of tiers, and tier 1, 2, 3, 4, or whatever, it is the layers behind the OEM, original equipment manufacturer. Right. So, in order to understand this, we need to understand a very simple drawing. You have some, here is water into a tank, and you tap it with an input of flows of materials, in this case water. And you cannot have an inventory level. This, all the tank is the inventory. You cannot fill it eternally up. You need to stop somewhere, because it can hold only that much amount of water. And then you have always a strap flow, and you have an output flow. And of course, this should be just a dribble, and this should be a flow. Hopefully. Then you can perhaps make money. Right? So if you understand this very simple drawing, then it is easier to understand what we are now going into. Yeah. So, it is a balancing act, inventory, about pros and cons. And when we are talking about small inventories, we are talking about cost of storage, cost of inventory. Is it that you can have on one side, you can have that, is it that important to reduce this storage? It only costs a few euros, kroners, or dollars, or whatever. But on the other hand, in a big company, you have many of these, and together it is quite a huge amount of money. And then you have the capital cost, because often you have bought the materials that you have in inventory and storage, right? And you need to finance that. And then you have the handling cost. You always need to handle the inventory. And then you have taxes, insurance, wastage, etc. Also. So all of these kinds of pressure, pros and cons. You can argue that towards cons, you can argue that it's a little bit of amount of money to do this. We don't have a big capital cost on it. We don't have, it is automatic, it is not a very big handling cost, and tax, insurance, and wastage are low. But on the other hand, if you, for instance, have a little storage of milk which has a date where you cannot sell it, then it kind of turns the table, doesn't it? Then the pros comes in. So try to understand how you are going, if you're going to write about this or do such an analysis later on in life, then you need to look at the pros and cons. These are for the small inventory, and you have, of course, a little bit different on big inventories, because then you are talking about customer service level. Do you know what that is? What is customer service level? You don't know. Let us. I ordered, not me, but my wife ordered some clothing on the internet yesterday. Today I got a notice that this package was on the way. That is a level of service which is really great. We ordered it in late last night, and in the morning today it was on its way. But 2 weeks ago I ordered a book, and when I order a book, you can imagine that these books are not mainstream books. And it was a fortnight ago. And still, it has not been sent through the deliveries at all. They say they have it on stock, but they don't. They haven't sent it. So you can see, these are different service levels. But I'm not complaining. At in clothing, I expect as a customer to get my clothing quite quickly. But I know that these books I order, they are not mainstream. They are, not the best sellers, to say it in this way. So then it is okay for me to wait a little bit longer. Can you see that? So that is service level. So that is very, very important. Yes?
I think our expectations to the service level change because we get used to that the service level maybe gets better. For example, you get a message that the package is on its way. So some years ago, we never expected to get such a message.
Yes, but then again, you have to look at the competition.
Yes.
When I go into a shop to buy clothing, I expect to go out of the shop with something in my bag. Mm. That's me, not my wife. She needs to go to every store there is before she... Yeah, that's a different story. But anyhow, I expect to buy clothes today when I have decided now I'm going to look for it. We didn't expect that from bookstores either. They perhaps had the book, but it was all right to wait. They could order it, and it was in the next year, next week, not next year. But it was kind of, at least when you did not buy mainstream books. Right? So you need to look at the expectations, as you said, but also about the competition. So it is kind of these two. Then you have the cost of ordering. There is a cost related to order. And which type of order do I mean? It is not... mostly it is for the company to order from their suppliers we are talking about, not the customer's orders. It can be. But there you need to be clear. What are you going to talk about? Because orders are both ways. Building cost? Not building as such, but you can build inventory. Utilization of manpower and equipment, I think that you understand that's covered. Then you have transport and you have payments. And remember that you can get a discount for paying very, very quickly. That is quite usual. So you can perhaps, if you buy it, if you pay what you have bought in 10 days in professional life, then perhaps you get 2% off. And if you multiply 2% each 10 days up to a whole year, it is a quite a nice saving. And many businesses do their revenue once more on this.
Is this common in the industry, such deals?
Yeah.
A part of the contract between the buyer and the buyer?
Yeah. But this is not Kanban system or just-in-time inventory and so on. Because this is all due to the financial side. Right. Now I'm over the limit. So, time limit. Let us then take a break and then we rejoin on 15 minutes, shouldn't we? Okay, then we have looked at the small inventory. Oh, hello. And the big inventory. Now we are going to look at something else. There are three main categories. This I think you understand. Raw materials, pipeline or work in progress, and finished goods. But we are now going to look at the classifications of inventory. It says storage. There again, I have a problem. Inventory and storage. It kind of get confused by me. Sorry. I mean inventory. Classifications of inventory, not storage. Storage is something else in English. But, yeah. All right. I will change it next time around. Okay. And now we are going to look at these four inventories classes. Here you have a picture of a supply chain, and you can see a supplier do have some raw materials, which is a raw material at the manufacturing plant. It's a raw material inventory, isn't it? And then they produce this to a nut and bolt. These are work in progress, and these are all also inventories, right? And then you have the finished goods inventory, which is going to a distribution center and then to a retailer. And the distribution center tends to have large packages of the product, and the retailer has small packages. You know this, I think. Okay, let's go for the cycle inventory. The lot size, Q, is important. The lot size, what is lot size? I say it varies directly with the usage, with the used time between orders. Lot size. What is it? No, no? Yes?
It's about the materials you need between each order from your supplier, and it has to do with demand from the market. So you need to make sure that you actually have enough material from...
It's not demand from the market. Eventually, it can be. You are thinking about just-in-time. You are thinking in lines of just-in-time, but you could also... I could also argue that lot size has nothing to do with the market. On the long run, I hope it has. But if I build inventory at one point or another, then it has nothing to do with the marketplace. You can see where I'm going. But the lot size is how much materials do I really need in and what? How much do the tap of output in the water container. How big is the diameter of that tube? If you remember the water container. Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. That's the lot size. So what we then say is the average cycle inventory is Q divided on tube. Does this make sense? The longer time between orders for a specific product, the larger the cycle inventory. Okay? Is this something that is, what can I say, something you understand? That's an example. Just forget it.
Okay.
Just take this. It's not an O, it's a zero. It is a zero. It's just meaning that you are starting. If I remember the example correctly, it doesn't matter. But if we don't use, or if the production is put in such a way that we use something from that storage, where really seldom it tends to, the average cycle time of the cycle inventory tends to be bigger. Yes?
It is because purely the reason for the formula is that you start with a full lot.
Yep.
And you go towards an empty lot.
Yep.
And the average is that.
Yeah. Yeah. You need. We are going to look at why we are. Why this is something that we need to calculate.
If I can comment one thing as well, because I think I remember either from technology management or quality management that you have to factor in things like lead time and.
Yeah, we are going through that. Because now we are talking about demands. These are not customers' demands, unless you say that the process next to you is the customer. And many companies has done this as a principle. So each process downstream from you is your customer. But I rather say just demand, and not specific as a customer demand. I think that is quite foolish. So now we are talking about pipeline, the work in progress inventory, because that is also parts that we have paid for, and we are transforming it to a product. And it's still inventory, even if we are working on it. And then you have the lead time. Here you have the lead time. So it is the average demand per period, small d, average, and large L, the number of periods the items lead time. So we divide, and that's what you actually did at Lean Lab.
Yep.
But you didn't do the math. You did it in a common sense way, didn't you? All right, then we have an example. This one. And then you can try to use those two formulas. Here you have a plant making monthly shipments of electric drills to a wholesaler on average lot size of 280 drills. So the lot size here means how much they ship at one period of time, right? The wholesaler's average demand, and here demand is the customer, is 70 drills per week, and the lead time for the plant is 3 weeks. So they need 3 weeks to produce something, right? The wholesaler must pay for the inventory from the moment the plant makes a shipment. So you can look at, I should have looked it up, but I didn't. What kind of payment that is, but you can look it up yourself. It's just FOB, I think. Free on board. I think it's called FOB. But anyhow, if the wholesaler is willing to increase its purchase quality to 350 units, the plant will give priority to the wholesaler and guarantee a lead time of only 2 weeks. What is the effect on wholesalers' cycle and pipeline inventories? Do you understand this? These are very much something that we need to address in practice. So, should I put up the formulas? Should I put up the formulas on the board? No. Sorry. So these are the formulas, and you need to first calculate the current cycle and pipeline inventories for the wholesaler. Right?
Yeah.
The current cycle inventory is 140. So, if we go back, does this fit? 280 divided on 2 is 140, isn't it?
No.
It's something that you can do without a calculator. And then the pipeline inventory is 70 drills per week in 3 weeks. All right? And that's 210. Are you with me so far? Are we, or should I go back and look, point at the where the numbers came from? No, all right. You're with me so far. That's all right. This is difficult to... No, it's not that difficult. So, first of all, you enter your average lot size and the average demand and average lead time, and then compute the cycle inventory, simple, divided by 2, and compute the pipeline inventory by multiplying the average demand by the lead time, and then we get this 175 and 140. What does this mean? Let us put it up. Cycle inventory 175 and pipeline inventory is equal to 140. Right? And we did have these are future. Right? That's the offer, or offer, and the present was 140 and 210. Is this something that you Will you accept the offer from the plant, the producer of the electric drills? Yes?
So what you're saying is that once the plant ships something to us, we pay for it.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as that is true, we want the pipeline cost to be as low as possible.
Yes.
So as long as the pipeline cost goes from 210 to 140, it's actually beneficial for us.
Yeah. So you would accept the new offer.
Yeah.
Does everyone agrees on that? You are smiling.
Could you just go back one picture to the pipeline?
This?
Yes, on the how the DL, what was the background for the
okay. This? Okay. All of the slides are, of course, uploaded in Blackboard, and I will make some changes and upload it again because it was a little bit confusing. Storage and inventory. Storage is something else.
You also have inventory and
logging. Yeah. Yeah, all right. Okay, I will do that. Thank you. Well, it wasn't me. It was somebody else that... Yeah, right. Okay. No, that's too far. If you go back to the text, as you argued, that you are paying for the inventory from the moment the plants make a shipment. So you are paying as soon, if I'm the plant and selling to you, as soon as the product leaves my factory floor, and are on their way to you, then it's your responsibility, and you pay me. So that's one of the key questions here. And then you need to have as little inventory as possible. But do you do that? Yes, you will. And what was your point was that this one perhaps is more important to look at than this one. That was your point. And I do agree. In this case, I do agree.
I can clarify the argument.
Yes, please do.
Just for the benefit maybe of others. The thing is, the cycle inventory is a cost for the plant.
Yes.
And in this example, the pipeline inventory is a cost for the customer. So as a customer, you always want the pipeline cost to be as low as possible. It might not be as beneficial to the manufacturer in this case, but that's not your problem.
It's not that easy, but because the cycle inventory, if that goes up, then I need to make a lot of money to pay for the next shipment.
Yeah, but
if I don't have that type of money, let's say that this goes up from 240 to 340. and I don't have that type of money, then I don't want that huge lot size.
But do you agree that by having a bigger cycle inventory for the plants, they have to, their storage cost or their inventory cost has to go up because their inventory is actually much larger. So for the plant, their cost goes up, but also their income goes up. But it's an easier argument to accept that new deal for the customer than for the plant.
Yeah. Yes, it is. And you have to combine this with what you learned last time, with capacity. So you cannot make such an offer if you are running on full capacity.
No.
Right? So you need to combine what you have already learned and what you now is learning, perhaps.
And would you still recommend, like last week you said, you should stay at or about 80%?
Yeah.
So within that offer, you should still stay at 80%?
Yes, yeah. Because that's a different argument. Running my machinery at 100% or whatever percentage, if I run the machinery and the people too much, they break down. People and machinery. Machinery I can fix. People is more difficult to fix. That's no easy solution. Right? So that's... But that is a different kind of argument. Because that's inside one company. This example is between two entities. You see? And it kinds of what is beneficiary for the plant, it kinds of, in this example, is beneficiary for the wholesalers, but it perhaps isn't. You can easily put up some other numbers that change this. And the main point here is when you pay for the shipment. If you pay pre-order, then the line of argument is different. Okay, let's move on. This you can play with at home, I think. And it's important to understand. And it's not very easy to understand either. But it's really important to understand. So how can I reduce inventory? Because all of this chapter is about reducing inventory. It has no recollection of anorectic company. But there are many discussions about making it too lean and making it in an anorectic company. So remember that you cannot just reduce everything. Then you push the people and the machinery too much. There is a difficulty or a danger there. But here you can see, of course you can reduce the lot size. If you're going to reduce cycle inventory, you can reduce the orders and set up cost to help reduce queue, the lot size. You can increase the batches. Increased batches can reduce setup and tool changes. Did you understand this? If I produce, let's say, I go from 100 to 200, then I reduce the cycle inventory by 100. Because I take 200 away from that inventory at one period of time rather than just taking 100. Okay? And one other main thing is to safety stock inventory. That is something to do with me having the knowledge that I have inventory enough to produce at every period of time. So I don't go into, let's say you have the inventory the next room, I go in there and it's empty. Wow. Then rest stops. That's silly. So then we have something we call safety stock. We need at least this. That's safety stock. So in order, if you have put a safety stock level, then in order to reduce it, you can set the orders closer to delivery time. So what then it does is that I fill up the inventory very close to when I actually need to be produced. Improve demand prognosis, of course. Cut production time. This you have done at Lean Lab, didn't you? You started with a huge safety stock. This was the thing that you didn't manage, where the instructors just managed it for you, didn't they? You started with 7 or 8 houses, and they just took some houses away between each interaction. But you did cut production time. That you did. You did not reduce the uncertainty, but in some ways you could argue that you did, between the two stations at least, because you balanced the production and make learning efforts. Of course you did. Anticipation inventory is a different thing. It's what do I think it can be, what can be the demand. And this is very much used when we are talking about seasonal products, like skis. You don't sell skis in summertime, do you? So then it is very interesting to have anticipation inventory and use that kind of methodology to think about how much inventory I do need. These are very very different ways of thinking. So what does Matsus, which is the ski producer just upstream here, what does they do? You think, how do they think about their demands? What do they do in order to make a more secure prediction of the demand? Do you have any idea? Because they don't sell anything in the summertime. They sell all of it in the wintertime. That's a difficult company to run, isn't it? What do you think? Yes?
Maybe make something different in the summertime?
Yeah. Off-season campaigns, for instance. Of course, they could do, or introduction of seasonal pricing. That's the other way. But they actually do something that is not present in this. They make their customers order a year before, almost a year before. So when it comes in, let's say, January, February, all the retail chains set their orders for the skis next year. And then they know the main bulk of demand is such and such, which they can produce during the summertime and off-season. And then they just supply during the wintertime. That's a way to do it. Yes?
Just a thought, really.
Yes.
Because what you're basically talking about now is kind of risk management as well.
Yes.
And
this
what they do is move the risk from themselves to the retailer.
Yeah.
And is that really sustainable long term? Let's say we have 3 or 4 bad winters in a row. Maybe not.
Mm-hmm.
So
that is the main issue. Very, very good. It is truly the main issue they are talking about, because what they actually do, like you say, they take their risk and put it to the retailer. All the risk in the sport branch is taken by the retailer. And then you have a build-up of inventory at the retailer side. And the retailer needs to have two types of inventory, at least two types, winter and summer inventory. That is very, very demanding on cost. You need a huge capital base to run a sports shop. Because during the summertime, you don't sell winter products, which you didn't sell during that winter. And as you point out, what about bad winters? Yes, so during a bad winter, I don't know if it's going to be a bad winter in January, February, because it can't turn. It is before the winter holiday and the Easter holiday, where most of the skis are sold. But I have the Christmas holiday behind me. So it's kind of an indication of how the winter is going to behave, or the season. But it is risky. And you can see that in order for you to take on that risk as a retailer, you demand a high calculation rate. So you calculate your product very high in order to take that risk. But of course, it is truly, truly bad. And you two, I think you have gone through the beer game I invented.
Yep.
Yeah, you have.
And we did with the...
I started that.
Yep.
So the beer game is about how does small fluctuation in demands transform back through the supply chain. And that is really something difficult, really something else. So you can have a small fluctuation of demands at the retailer, But when it comes to the wholesaler, it kind of grows a little bit. And then when it comes to the OEM, original equipment manufacturer, it goes even further. And then at the supply tier one, it's bigger, and et cetera, et cetera. So this is truly difficult, really, really difficult. And if you go through that, it is very, very much a big, big issue. I'm not going into that, but if you like, I can look up if I have a description of this. And put it on the blackboard for you, so you can read it. But it's really true. No, that was... I'm confusing to have two machines. Okay, in order to do the pipeline inventory, you can, of course, reduce production time. No wonder. If I reduce production time, I reduce the pipeline inventory. Find new suppliers with better delivery rates. If I can have one piece each hour during the production, during the day, it's easier for me to balance my production than having 100 pieces delivered or the first of every month, isn't it? Okay, I can change Q where the production time depends on lot sizes. That is also something you can just look at. I hate this. Yeah. But it is also interesting to understand where the inventory is located in the supply chain. So, now we're talking about big volumes, like groceries and so on. So that was the main point in the grocery branch in Norway. And what you have seen in the grocery branch in Norway, you have seen that the supply chain is getting smaller. We only have three main branches right now. We have Coop, we have Rema, and we have Norgesgruppen. Those three, they control all the groceries we ever buy in Norway. Quite frightening, actually, I think. And what they did was to calculate all of these up and down, and they did something which was called the reverse discount system. I'm not going into that, but I was at that branch at that period of time when they started to really put the pressure on the OEMs, which I was working in. And they did not only pressure us on price, but also on deliveries, etc. Right? Yes, the measure of supply chain performance is this. This is how we try to calculate the overall performance of the supply chain. And remember, still we are talking about many companies, many entities at different levels. So we are not talking about one company now, we are talking about many. Right? And of course, here you have item A, the volume and the value. Volume of B and value of B, or the price, cost. And the weeks of supply is the average aggregated inventory value divided on week sales. At cost. Why at cost? You can figure that out yourself, because I think it is in the slides. You can understand that by the slides. I hope you have read the article I put up. But you can, that could be a discussion. Why do we divide it on the value of weekly sales at cost and not at as the prices we have on the sale. Annual sales at cost divided on average aggregated inventory value. That's inventory turnover. So weeks of supplies, it is this, and then we turn the table and get the inventory turnover. What do we use that for? Here you have an example. Eagle Machine Company averaged $2 million in inventory last year. I need to stand here. And the cost of goods sold was $10 million. Figure 9.7, I'm going to show that later, shows a breakout of raw materials, work in progress, and finished goods inventory. The best inventory turnover in the company's industry is 6 turns per year. If the company has 52 business weeks per year, how many weeks of supply were held in inventory? What was the inventory turnover, and what should the company do? All right? Do you understand this? All right? If you do, we are going. I forgot this. Then we're doing this. Here you have the different inventories, raw material, work in progress, and finished goods, all summarized up. And here you say, see the volume and the value multiply each other, and then it is multiplied. Put together here to 2 million. The average weekly sales at cost is not 2 million, but this, and weeks of supply is 10.4, and the inventory turnover is 5. What does this mean? It takes 5. What does 5 mean? Yes?
It's 5 weeks for their inventory to be 0.
Yeah. If you don't supply, or we turn over 5 weeks. That is quite good, actually. If it was a retailer. Right? And 5 times, no, you said weeks. 5 times a year.
I was talking about weeks of supply. Inventory turnover is how many times your inventory is emptied per year.
Yeah. Let's correct it. It is per year.
Yeah.
I said yes. So
it's a weeks of supply.
Yeah. And it takes 10 weeks to get a new one. New lot size. Right? So that is that one. A recent accounting statement showed total inventories, raw material, work in progress, and finished goods to be actually 6.821,000 dollars. This year's cost of sold goods is 19.2 million. The company operates 52 weeks per year. How many weeks of supplies are being held, and what is the inventory turnover? And it's the same way around. And you can see that we have the figures put in the formula, and here we flip it. Right? Go through this and look at what it says. Don't, if you calculate it wrongly, it doesn't matter. It's more how you argue for that. But now we take a break. I need more coffee and you need a break, I think. Ja, nei, men ja, det passer godt, jeg skal. Ja, det passer godt, for jeg skal til Lausanne I dag, så jeg må forte meg litt, jeg også. All right. Yes. These are the financial measurements, and we are going to go through them, because not all of you are familiar with such financial statements and measurements. So, total revenue, cost of goods sold, operating expenses, cash flow, working capital, and return on assets. Two of you knows these things, I hope. But perhaps you learn something. I'm not quite sure. But anyhow, let us go through them. It will eventually turn up. I didn't manage to take this away, but anyhow. What we here see is total revenue is the sales. It is, in other words, from sales. But revenue is the sales reduced by, for instance, discounts or something like that. Right? Cost of goods sold is how much did it cost us? And this is really, really important because the difference between total revenue and cost sold is what we earn to pay for our fixed costs. Are you with me so far?
I think so.
Yeah? And what we have left from this is net income. Overskudd på norsk. Right? Are you with me so far? That's net income. Okay? And then? No, that's too far. Then we have net cash flow. And now we are talking about how much cash flows through our system. And there are two types of cash. The ones we own as owner of the company, and the ones the others own. So when I buy something from you, and you, as you said in the hallway, you give me 90 days credit, then it is some money from you that flows through my company in 90 days before I pay you. But in 90 days, you are part of the cash, my cash flow, since your parts are in my production, which actually you own in 90 days. Right? You understand this? So that is cash flow and inventory, as we have spoken of. So these two is the working capital. What works? How much money works in the factory? Right? And then you have fixed assets. It's all the machinery, buildings, etc., cars, etc. If you divide these two, then you have total assets. Right? And then you multiply net income on total assets, and then you get a return on investment. How? Nay, on assets, isn't it?
Yep.
Assets, yes. Return on assets is how much do I, or do it capitalize?
Yeah.
It is almost, what?
Interest.
How much interest does my company generate? Right?
And that's just a comment of it.
Yeah.
It's really important as well, not only for business owners, but also for, let's say, investors. You want the ROA to be higher than, example, the passive interest from banks, etc.
Of course, because if you put money or deliver something to me, you need to make more money than if you put all your money into the bank and did not produce anything. Because you are taking a risk, and the risk is me. Because I do not going to pay you until it has gone 90 days. Then you see your money. And that risk you need to profit from. That's the main point. And this model is called the DuPont model, if you are going to look it up. And what you can also do, here the arrows goes one way, all of them. But if you are going to analyze a company, you can do this by putting the numbers from the income sheet. And do the numbers and the balance sheet. But when you are then looking at the ROA, return on assets, and it's perhaps low, perhaps you get an interest rate of 10%. That's kind of low. I would say 20%. At least, because you take good, huge amount of risk. Then you can go, if you're going to invest, what is wrong with the company? Then you go the other way. Is this too low? If it's this one and not that one, you know that it has to be something with the assets. The way you you finance the company. And then you can go here. Do I have enough working capital, or do I have over-invested in fixed assets? If it's not enough working capital, is it? Do I have a cash flow problem? For instance, perhaps I can't pay you in 90 days. I'm going to call you and say I need 30 more days. And that's how we use this. And we use it a lot. Try to do this back home. Take whatever company you can find. There's lots of these online. And put the numbers in the different boxes. And multiply and divide. And then go back and forth. And you will see quite easily the problems the company faces. I think this is rather easy, so I hope you find it also. But if you have problems, please contact me. All right? What you also will encounter a lot is the thing called mass customization. This is something different. It has arrived some years now, but we are moving to more individualized, mass individualized products. But I'm not going into what is individualized. I'm going to talk about mass customization. And what it is that we can produce now lots and lots of variants of the same product. Think of a car. If you buy a new car, you can choose colors, externally, internally, you can choose options of equipment, etc., etc. There are lots and lots. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, the F-150, the most sold car in the world, it is a Ford pickup truck. I think it's in 17,000 variants. That's a lot. So that's mass customization. So we produce it as in a mass production site, but we can change most of it. So you can more or less have what you think it should look like. But it kind of deals with these three issues. How we manage the customer relations, how we eliminate finished goods inventory, and increase perceived value of the service or product. Let's go to the middle one, the finished goods inventory. If you decide whatever car you really want, and you suddenly say that, no, I don't want it anymore, then I have a problem. Because in 17,000 variants, it's kind of difficult to find the one person who wants just that variant. You see where I'm going now? So, what do you think is the solution for that?
To sell it for a lower price than the customer could.
Yeah,
just
but. What I. Yeah, yes?
I would do the same as the example that we used before. Transfer the risk at the moment of the order, if you can.
Mm-hmm. Good. I would say that you need to pay me up front, or at least a deposit. Yes?
But actually, I think that Elin is sort of right, because I think
yeah.
I've experienced this in real life. You know, when you look at something ordinary, it costs, for example, look well, at the brand Apple, they have, you know, the red product.
Yeah.
It always costs more, and they say that some of it will go to, you know, the some AIDS Foundation.
Yes. Yes, of course he has a correct answer, or at least there are no correct answer. But in the car example, you always need to put up a deposit. That's the way they secure themselves. But when I do change my mind, then you need a discount in order to sell it to someone else. And of course you have right. And of course, if you do this, if you complicate it a little bit more and say, what about seasonal products like skis? If they are going to have 17,000 variants of the same ski, what then? It doesn't happen just because it's really tricky to manage. But what if? Then we have a problem. And the bigger problem is the individualized mass production, where you order a car with a gear knob with your initials. Then it's kind of tricky. First, I need to, of all the variants, I need to find the one that really likes your color taste and settings and so on, and have your initials so that the gear knob matches. That's a tricky one, yes?
It's really kind of the practice that has to become kind of best practice in a market kind of depends on the volume sold.
Mm-hmm.
Like if you're talking about laptops, cell phones, all that, the volume is quite large.
Yes.
So you can afford
to take a higher risk as a manufacturer, because by the end of, let's say, 1 million or 2 units sold, you still make a lot of money.
Mm.
You're talking about cars, or even worse, like buildings and such, the volume is much less. So you need to kind of make the customer take more of the risk to kind of make money.
Yes. So what we are talking about here is assembly to order strategy versus modular design versus postponement. So this, I do have all the major part in inventory, but I don't assemble them until I get an order from you. That's the first one. Second one is to, in order to reduce the numbers of variants, I package some of the variants, like a car where you have this type security package, where you get this and that and this technology, all packaged in one. You pay for the package. You cannot say that I don't want every of these three technologies, I just want that one. No, you can't have that. Then you need to buy all three, unless you don't want that. So that is modular design, or at least an example of that. Postponement is that I don't do anything until you pay me. Right? You see the difference? So that is what we have been talking about. Now I'm going into something else. It is outsourcing. Why should we do everything ourselves? And this is the make-buy decisions. Either we do it ourselves or we buy it from the marketplace. And now we are in the middle of transaction cost economics. So then I'm going for this PC, I'm going for something. I'm not translated yet. I'm going to translate it. Relation specific investment, it says on the top of the screen. So if I am OEM, original equipment manufacturer, and you are my supplier, then you can think of us as a relationship. And there are some, perhaps some special tools that we need to invest in order to make this happen. Perhaps my parts, what I need, is a little bit different than when you sell to her. Do you understand this? And then the tools that you need to put in your machinery in order to deliver to me, you can only deliver it to me. You can't deliver it to her. Then this is a specific, relation-specific investment. And then you have insecurity and opportunism. This theory is about opportunism. It's with Gail, it says. Hello. Are you with me? It's funny. All right. And if you think you can make a little bit more money by fooling me a little bit, then you do it. That's opportunism in this line of theory. So that's the baseline. So I need to every time to investigate that you are not doing something like that. And you, from your side, need to investigate that I'm not doing that. Right? Yes?
This is very connected to hostage taking as well?
Yes, we are going. We are just covering the bases before we are going to the hostage. And then is the frequency. Of course, if you are delivering to me every day, and I'm paying you, sometime.
Up to 30 days.
Yeah, right. Then we have a close relation. But with him, I don't have that close relation. He is delivering some part I perhaps need sometimes. That's only when she is ordering a new car with her initials on the gear knob. Quite seldom, actually. But anyhow, I buy it from him. Then the frequency is less. We don't have that kind of close relation. You see this?
Sure.
So you need these three dimensions. Remember this when we go through the rest of it. It was here. So, this is the transaction process. It is a simplified thing, just in order to understand. Here you have the order, the time of the order. And then it is the production, and then you have the delivery of that order. And I as a buyer, can any time during production withdraw my order. You cannot say to me, if I withdraw here, you can't say that, oh, I have produced 80%. Doesn't matter, that's your problem, not mine. Or I can withdraw here, before you start. Doesn't matter, right? So the hostage taking is when the buyer invests in specific assets and assigns them to the seller with the lowest bid. What does that mean? When the buyer, me, I invest in the specific assets, the relation specific assets you need in to produce in order to give me what I want. I invest in that asset and give it to you because you did have the lowest prices, right? Then we call that P whatever. Or we could think of it as the seller makes the specific asset investment. You makes the investment.
Mm-hmm.
And then receive some payment from me at the second period only if the buyer confirms the order. This means half. So I say to you that if you do the investment, then you get paid not only for the part, but also for the investment at this time.
Mm.
Understand this?
Yes.
But then you have a cash flow problem or a challenge, because all of the risk and all of the capital needed to produce everything, you only get paid here. So you need to finance all this period. The other one was that I invested here, gave you something.
You as the buyer,
Yes. And then your cash flow, your capital was only in cycle and pipeline inventory. Right? The other one is that the seller makes the specific asset investment. That's you. And receive something from the buyer if he confirms the order. And you get some kind of some kind of what is it called? Compensation.
Compensation.
Thank you. If I cancel, right? So, if we go back, you invest everything, but you have something that, if I cancel, at least you get something for the investment, but you don't get anything for the order. If I say I don't want it. Are you with me so far? And then we go here. These are the different outcome. So you can see that I take you as a hostage. Either or, you are going to take the biggest risk at all. Can you see this? And what you mentioned in the hallway was that the entrepreneurs, they get payment dates that exceeds the delivery dates. 90 days after delivery or whatever. Then I have 3 months. If I buy from you, then I need to finance something. And the way I finance this is not paying. So I buy something from you. You deliver it to me, and I have it in my possession. And I can sell it to any one of you. If I do that before 90 days has gone, then I take... I have the money before I pay. Then my position is quite good, isn't it?
That's what really very often happens in reality as well.
Yeah. Okay. And that is hostage taking. And this is this is one piece and simplified piece of transaction cost economics. And this is done throughout reality. And if I could complicate it, perhaps with, if we are going to have a close relationship, I'm going to say that you're going to learn a lot by producing to me. I want a percentage of your learning curve. So the price I pay for your products will decrease during the years. That's quite different, isn't it? Or I can say that the specific asset we do have, yeah, I own it. I can take it from you and put it in your factory tomorrow, because he can't produce enough, because I own the tools. And then suddenly most of your revenue is gone. Do you think he's a good guy then? Kind to me. He's very kind. Because he knows that I will do that if he don't behave. Can you see this? This is done a lot. And then I have taken him as a hostage. We can't do anything unless it pleases me. Can you see this? This is the harsh reality of business. And it's very, I think it's a very dark theory. Very harsh. But it's true in many ways. And it started as a way of thinking, why do we have firms at all? Because in a perfect market, we don't need firms. In a perfect marketplace, we don't need firms at all. We just switch services or goods or whatever. But that's not how capitalism works at all. So Coase, he was the first one to have this book, wonderful book, you could read that, called The Nature of the Firm, where he asked the simple question, why do we have firms? And this earned him the Nobel Prize in Economics. And then Williamson kind of took this to another level. And what we have gone through here is Williamson. He says that all the transactions between companies or firms can be thought of as a contract. Does the contract ever fulfill everything we need in order to engage in a partnership or a business relationship? No, we cannot. It's unfulfilled contracts. And in order to not taking too much risk and etc., he found that companies tend to secure themselves by hostage taking, and that gave him the Nobel Prize in economics. Yes.
Just a question. Yeah, I'm just trying to kind of connect the sustainability effects into this discussion, and like we talked about shortly last year about there is no such thing as a win-win situation.
Yeah.
As one part always wins and the other one always loses something, which is true for most cases, if not all cases. And the thing is, in my view, if one part is the hostage taker and the other one is kind of in a strained situation, that can't be sustainable long term. That has to collapse at one time or another time if you think about the long term.
Yeah, but then the answer is, look at the capitalism. In every period you have a book out called something about the end of capitalism, etc. It has not happened. So it kind of what the this theory kind of lacks is that perspective you now put forward. There are some theorists into that that part and trying to work out what is the elements that can reduce this kind of win-lose situation. But we are not there quite yet. Yes?
No, I was wondering about the statement, there's never a win-win situation.
Yeah.
Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah.
It's easy to
meet, so. This one, can you agree that this is not a win-win? This is me winning And perhaps he can win if he is a good guy.
Yeah.
If he don't behave, he loses. Alright? It is my well-being that depends if he is winning or not. Yeah.
I was thinking because I have no experience with the term you're using now. But from my real life, I've always had win-win situations.
Yeah.
You know, you buy something, you give them the money, and you get your product.
Yeah.
Always. It's like that all the time. You don't have to wait. Okay, of course, when you buy them online, you have to wait some days, but that's okay, because you know this in advance. You have predictability, you know what to expect, and when to.
But if you boil every transaction and every economic system down to its basis, that's what we are doing here, you can see that one part is better suited to win than the other. Orwell's books says it quite well, I think. Not quite remembering what it's called. Yeah.
1984.
No.
Not that one.
Not that one. I could come up with it. But yes, just. But we don't. It is what doesn't play, or what isn't visible, is that I do have the power, but I don't show it. As long as he behaves, then I don't need to show it. I don't need to risk the relationship. But try something else. Try to buy online and not pay.
No, I've never done that. I always pay upfront. Is there is there another way?
Yeah, of course you can buy on credit and not pay. Of course, you have Luxus Fällen.
My credit card.
Yeah. Luxus Fällen in the national TV. You can look at that and see how far they have managed to go before they actually faces this dark side of the system. And then, of course, you don't need to drive private persons to bankruptcy, but they do that in the firm world, in business world. You do that all the time, and the one entity that drives most businesses to bankruptcy is the government. If you don't pay your taxes, loans, etc., then it's out. But then you are out of business quite fast. So this is not far-fetched at all, but it's a side of capitalism, side of doing business, that is not very easy observed unless you misbehave. It's packed in. Yes.
Yeah, I was just kind of commenting on the same thing. There's a big difference between perceived winning and actual winning.
Yeah.
So you can actually think that you've gotten a good deal, but in reality, you're taking a big risk, for example.
Yeah, again, my wife and I, we have our quotes. She has the same education as I have, master's degree in business. And whenever she comes home and says she has earned money by buying this product with discount, I'm saying, really? How foolish are you? You're not saved any money at all. Yes, I have. And I really wanted it. Yeah, but you have
2,000 pairs, and of course it's a saturation. You have 2,000 pairs of shoes anyhow, so why do you need one more? Yeah. So you see the discounts and so on is some ways to make the perception that you get a good deal. But actually, you don't. Because...
But who is to decide that? I mean, if you want a new pair of shoes and you feel great and you got them in the sales, for you it's like a win situation.
Yeah.
Why shouldn't they?
Yeah.
Why can anyone else say that? No, you just lost. Why can't
no,
you say that?
But...
It's a feeling.
He... Let's say, he is the seller. He's a better guy.
Okay.
He has... A discount is something that is divided from whatever price. And if he puts whatever price up before he makes the discounts. He does that.
Okay.
It is, of course, not allowed, as you say, but think of it. Does it work? Yes. He can sell just one shoe with four times the price that he paid in the beginning as the cost. And of course he can say 20% off. That's a lot. He has only sold one to full price. One. And then he sells 200 with discounts. And you say, yes, I have bought it with 20% off.
Mm-hmm.
Wow! It's a